The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Solnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Hello again, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition for this week. This week, we continue our little journey, our multi-part or multi-show series on our retirement planning philosophy and approach. And in today's show, we're going to get into that ever-popular topic of the minimum dignity floor. We'll define that, what that is for people who may not know. Maybe you're new to our process and philosophy. Those regular longtime listeners probably have a good sense of what it is, but I think it's worth conversing about it with Jim's to kind of reveal our thoughts about it, how it fits into our entire process, kind of the origins of the minimum dignity floor, and how we propose you view that as part of your overall retirement plan. So Jim's joining me as usual. He's back from his little trip. Thanks again, those of you who put up with me in the Q&A show last week with the Social Security questions. I know those shows aren't quite as interesting or exciting. Volatile might be another word, since there's no random conversation topics that come up when I'm on there by myself. But Jim's back and had a nice weekend trip, and now we can proceed with our journey into the minimum dignity floor.
You know, you can have a conversation with yourself when I'm not on the show.
I know, but it feels and sounds kind of odd.
It's if you start answering yourself.
Well, I was imagining doing that.
How are you doing today, Chris? Well, I'm pretty good, Chris. How are you, Chris? Oh, I'm good. Yeah, then we'd probably lose some listeners at that point.
So,
Thank you for playing along. I first want to begin again by reminding everyone we're dedicating this series to my dad, mm-hmm. who has passed away several weeks ago, but many of his experiences as he aged help establish some of what I do with my clients, and I just felt it would be nice to dedicate this series to my dad. So, Dad, I want to say hi, and this is a continuation of a series dedicated to you. But back to what Chris was mentioning, I did fly for some odd reason, which I will never do again, because it was just too fast of a trip. But I flew out to Ohio to see some people, and I go on a hike and two. Actually, I went on two hikes. But I had just started feeling comfortable, and it was time to go home again. So to me, if I'm going to fly out again, I should do it as I normally do when I go to Ohio, and stay a couple of weeks. So I hope to revisit the area, the Ohio area. And I never announced on the podcast that I would be there, because I usually do, and then I try to meet podcast listeners who live in the area. But I wasn't there long enough to arrange any type of meeting like that. But I do feel I'll go back sometime over the summer. I have to experience humidity again. So most likely in July or August, I will venture out to Ohio for probably 10 to 14 days, and I will let listeners know when I will be there. One thing I do want to mention, and I don't think I did, I will be in Indianapolis shortly, and I believe I already have some people in the Indianapolis area that want to meet with me. So I will be in Indianapolis the evening of May 8th, 9th, and 10th. I believe I have people already who want to meet with me, so I don't know what my availability in Indianapolis will be. But then I fly on the 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, and 16th to Hollywood, Florida, not Hollywood, California. And apparently Hollywood, Florida is north of Denver and south of, what's that beach out there?
What do you mean north of Denver?
Fort Lauderdale.
Hopefully it's not north of Denver.
Is what?
You said north of Denver.
What's north of Denver?
What you were just talking about.
No, Florida's not north of... I know. Did I say... No, north of Miami. No. Okay. It's... Hollywood, Florida is north of Miami and south of Fort Lauderdale Beach. So it's kind of sandwiched in between there. Okay. So if anybody's in the Hollywood, Florida area, I believe I will have some availability Saturday the 11th till I think Thursday the 16th. I fly back to Denver on Friday the 17th. I'll be going to the EDGE conference there. Never went before. It is a combination now of an ETF conference. There is a practice management ETF. They have an AI track. So it's more about running a business, a financial planning practice, than going there to learn the latest RMD rules post-Secure 2. It's definitely more of trying to help run a business, which is where I'm being dragged more and more as the owner of the firm. So this will be my first time attending EDGE. So I'm kind of looking forward to it. Hopefully it'll be good. So if anybody is in the Hollywood, Florida area, and has nothing to do, send me an email. Maybe I can find some time and we can go grab a pina colada somewhere. That's what you would do, I guess, in late spring, early summer in Florida, grab a pina colada. Okay, anyways, back to the task at hand today. So today we want to kind of dedicate this to the concept of minimum dignity floor and secure income. Remember, especially if you're a newer listener, our approach to retirement planning is unique. It does not follow industry convention. It's an approach that I created myself for a variety of reasons. But it all began with the minimum dignity floor. When we first started, or when I first started this is before Chris even started working with me, I had no idea that there'd ever be a fund number concept, that there would be investment positioning, that there would be the see-through portfolio. All of these other terms and approaches that kind of make up what Chris and I call the secure retirement income process started coming about as I delved deeper and deeper and deeper into one simple concept. The concept that there are a group of expenses that every retiree must cover for the rest of their life, whether they have money or not. That these expenses do not go away. And I came up with this and the term minimum dignity floor in a way to, honestly, similar to how I'm dedicating this series to my dad. I came up with the name Minimum Dignity Floor because of an elderly woman who impacted me as a 30, 31, 32, I was somewhere between 30 and 32-year-old young police officer in Massachusetts. I had no intention of ever getting into financial planning, let alone specializing in retirement planning, and let alone developing a very unique and, I think, pretty darn good way of projecting retirement. The concept that we cover, that we now call the secure retirement income process. And it all came about, and I will share this brief story. Well, I'm going to keep it brief because I got a lot I want to cover today. Many of you heard this story, but if you're a relatively new listener, I think it's been over 6, 7, 8 months since we mentioned this story, Chris, the strawberry story.
Oh, I think at least, probably longer than that.
Maybe even longer than that. A lot of times people ask me, folks, Jim, you're a cop. You had a master's in criminal justice. You were on the SWAT team. You were going to be promoted detective. How the hell did you become a financial planner? It's kind of a simple reason. And again, I was in my early 30s. I was going to a grocery store called Shaw's. If you live in southeastern Massachusetts, there's Shaw's everywhere, similar to how we have King Supers out here, Chris, and Safeway. Shaw's back home is pretty big. I was going to the local Shaw's at the intersection of Route 6 and 140. So if you grew up in New Bedford, you know where I'm talking about. And when I was in there, I had the little basket you carry. And I just had a few items to this day. That's how I do the majority of my grocery shopping. If I can't hold it in that handbasket, then I'd come back later for it. I just hate pushing a cart around and checking out $600 worth of groceries at once. So I had this little hand cart in my hand, and I went to the express checkout lane. And there was only one person in that lane, an elderly woman. And at the time, I was knee-deep into being a cop. I loved being a cop. And I still respect police officers dearly, but I would never be a cop, especially in today's day and age. But at the time, 30 years ago, I was all over it. It was no better thing to do when you're in your late 20s, early 30s, and full of testosterone. So I was still in this cop mode. And when I went into the checkout counter, I knew instantly something was not right with this woman. And I knew it because she never acknowledged me. She never looked in my direction at all. She just kept staring at the checkout screen as the items were scanned across the scanner. And I just found that odd because most people will at least glance at the person who just started clunking down. That first, I put that ruler down that kind of separated my groceries from hers, and there weren't too many of her groceries left that hadn't been scanned. And I'm plopping my groceries down. She never looked. I often say that she had the eyes of Mike Singletary. If anybody remembers Singletary, I think he was a middle linebacker, wasn't he, Chris? I'm pretty sure he was a middle linebacker for the Bears. And you could only see his eyes through his helmet as he's staring at the quarterback intently. Her eyes reminded me of Singletary staring at a quarterback, but she was staring at the checkout screen. And when the last item got scanned, you can all probably guess what it is. Chris and I gave it away. But when that last item got scanned, I knew something wasn't right because her body language, that's what we were taught to look for as police officers, body language. Her body language gave herself away. Her shoulders hunched down, her back rolled, and she let out a very silent, but audible enough that I heard it, sigh. It was like, as her shoulders were rolling, and hunching down rather, and her back was rolling. And she looked up at the clerk and said, "Can you remove those? I can't afford them." And the clerk pressed a few keys, picked up what was a pint of strawberries, scanned it a second time, and put it down next to the cash register. I reached across. I don't know why I did this. I didn't sit there. I didn't think about it. I didn't analyze it. I just reached across, picked up the strawberries, put them back down on the woman's side, on the whole other side of the checkout counter, and told the clerk, "I will buy those." And I handed the clerk a couple of dollars, and I got a little bit of change back. To this day, I don't know how much. And that elderly woman started acting like I was Moses who just parted the Red Sea. She kept thanking me and thanking me and thanking me repeatedly in the grocery store, almost to the point where I was getting a little bit annoyed and embarrassed. By now, there's two or three people behind me in this fast checkout lane, and we're not moving. It's just this woman going on and on about me buying a pint of strawberries for her. If anybody grew up in Massachusetts, we're called massholes for a reason, and you don't want to wait in the express checkout line. And I could sense and feel the annoyance of everybody around me. So I just kept telling this woman, it's okay, ma'am. It was my pleasure. Enjoy. Have fun. Have a nice day. Enjoy the strawberries. And finally, the woman walked away. I took care of my groceries, and I started walking out the door. I had two bags of groceries, one in each arm. And I'm walking out the door. When I got into the parking lot, through the door, the elderly woman was still there. And as soon as she saw me, she wheeled her carriage up to me. And she stopped. And she started thanking me again. And now I'll admit, folks, I was annoyed. Again, I'm in my early 30s. I've got things to do. I can't remember today what I had to do, but at the time it was something important, I suppose, because I just wanted to get out of there. It was no big deal. I bought a pint of strawberries. And I just told him, ma'am, it was my pleasure. And I turned to walk away. And I say this all the time. What she did next changed my life forever. And I think changed the lives of hundreds, if not maybe thousands of people. I don't know. But she reached out, grabbed me by the shoulder. She was shorter than me. So she reached up, grabbed my shoulder, pulled it down. And with her other hand, she pointed, I kid you not, folks, right up into my face. And her finger is pointing right in my face. And I always will remember these words, and it's verbatim. She said, no, you don't understand. And I looked down at her. And I said, what don't I understand? I was curious now. What don't I understand? She went on to tell me that she said something to the effect of, I am 78 years old and I live on just Social Security. And my next check doesn't come for 10 days. Back then, checks were mailed. Today, it's all electronic. My next check doesn't come for 10 days. And if you didn't buy me strawberries, I wouldn't have had any. And then in typical Massachusetts or masshole fashion, she wanted to make it perfectly clear to me. She is going to say thank you as often as she wants. And I got to take it because she looked at me and she said, so. And then she accentuated this next part. She looked at me. She said, so thank you. And she really accentuated the thank in thank you. And with that, she started to walk away. And that changed my life. I don't know why, folks, but it did. I couldn't take my eyes off her. And I started thinking to myself and realizing something. I don't know what it's like to grow old. My grandparents had both passed away. My parents were younger than I am today. I don't know old people. And I thought to myself, this is it? This is what happens to us as we age? We can't buy strawberries? And I wondered if my grandparents, did they afford strawberries? And I thought to myself, well, they always had strawberries when I was there. My Nana used to give me $5 or $10, and she used to tell me, don't tell your grandpa, as if my grandfather would have got upset. So they didn't seem to be tight on money, but I didn't know. And I remember saying to myself out loud, I kid you not, folks, in the parking lot, I said to myself, I'm not going to let this happen to me. And I walked back to my car. I put my groceries in the back seat of the car. And back then, there was no Google. You couldn't Google how to retire, how to save money, how to invest. What is retirement? I'm 32 years old. You think I know any of that stuff? No. So back then, if you wanted to learn something, you did one of two things. You went to the library, or you went to a bookstore. And I went to a bookstore. And it wasn't too far away from that Shaw's. The bookstore has since closed. But there was a bookstore just a couple of buildings over from that Shaw's. I went into that bookstore, and I remember buying a magazine called Mutual Fund, which isn't even in existence anymore. But I had no idea what a mutual fund was, so I bought a magazine called Mutual Funds. I bought Money Magazine, I bought the Wall Street Journal, and I've read it ever since. And I might have even bought Barron's, I can't remember. It just consumed me. And the rest, as they say, is history. Shortly after that incident, I suffered an on-duty injury, and police department thought I wasn't going to be able to be a cop anymore, and I was faced with having to change careers, so started studying financial planning at Boston University, because in the Boston Globe, in the business section, this is a couple of years after this whole incident happened, I saw an ad for the Boston University program for financial planners, and I was working the day shift at the time. And I thought, well, if I'm not going to be able to be a cop forever because of my knee injury, I get to learn something else. So I started going to night school at BU studying financial planning, and the rest is history. But I've never forgot that woman, obviously, because I can recite the story as if it happened yesterday. And I call the minimum dignity floor, the MDF or dignity, in honor of her, because her insistence of thanking me, her insistence of approaching me in the parking lot and then grabbing me by the shoulder and telling me, no, sit your ass down here and you listen to me, you young whippersnapper. You don't know what you're doing. If she didn't do that, I don't think I'd be here. I'd still be a cop somewhere. Seriously. But she took the time to drill into my head that I don't understand what it's like to be old. And not to be able to afford things and being stuck living on just a steady Social Security paycheck. Now, most of you listening, you're not going to be in that situation. And I get that. But the concept of the minimum dignity floor, which definitely came about because of this incident, applies to everyone. And when I started studying financial planning and I started really getting into retirement planning in particular and started specializing and thinking, what don't I like about the entire industry? And there's many. I could do a 10-part series on what I hate about my industry. But part of what I didn't like is their, I guess, laissez-faire attitude, if you will, about some expenses. That to me, it was just common sense. There's certain expenses. And food, where strawberries would fall, is one of them. That a retiree, no matter how long they live, must cover. And I broke them into very broad categories. Food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. And I decided to call them the minimum dignity floor out of respect for her, because she could not have felt dignified when she got home. She had strawberries, and she was probably very happy. Hopefully they lasted 10 days, so when she got her Social Security check, she could get more. But she couldn't have felt dignified. Now, in hindsight, I wish I called them the minimum lifestyle floor, because minimum dignity floor imparts, it's the minimum amount to barely get by, to live kind of a dignified life. That's never how I meant it. Minimum lifestyle floor, or MLF, would have been much better, although I jokingly say in hindsight, in light of where the internet went, MLF is too close to another four-letter initialism that has nothing to do with minimum dignity floor and lifestyle expenses, and would probably drive a tremendous amount of very young men to our website. So I'm kind of glad MLF didn't take off as well. But MDF is not the minimum amount to keep you out of poverty. It's what you need to live the lifestyle you are accustomed to. Because it's not dignified to be in your 70s, 80s, or 90s and not being able to enjoy the same fruit you enjoyed in your 40s, 50s, and 60s. So that's why I name it the minimum dignity floor. But at face value, they are expenses that will continue for the rest of your life. In 25 plus years of doing this, no one has ever, ever proven to me a retiree does not need food, utilities, transportation, housing, or healthcare expenses fully satisfied. And then once I came up conceptually with the minimum dignity floor, it was just common sense to me that those expenses should be covered with an income stream that will last the rest of your life, whether you have money or not. And that income stream I call secure income. But before I go any further into the secure income realm, I'm going to turn this over now to Chris, who's going to talk to you about the minimum dignity floor. Now, you know conceptually how we came about, what it is intended for, why it's named MDF. But it is a series of expenses. How does he go about in his team helping people formulate the MDF? Where do certain expenses fit into the MDF? And where do taxes play with the MDF? And Chris, before you get to the tax part, talk about everything else. I want to mention an email we received about the tax part before you explain conceptually where taxes fit into your MDF. Not where taxes fit into your retirement as a whole. Just in the narrow focus right now on today's show on MDF. So why don't you walk people now through the MDF of how to determine it? It's actually more easier than most people probably think.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. Before I get into those details, I want to just set the stage so people maintain perspective on the purpose of establishing the minimum dignity floor. In our approach, the purposes of establishing the minimum dignity floor itself, the size of those expenses that create the minimum dignity floor, it's so that we can have an estimate, a reasonable estimate, for how much lifetime secure income you need to then protect. It plays hand in hand, if you will, between the two. So the purpose of establishing, through all reasonable efforts, the size of the minimum dignity floor, and it's an estimate. Nobody knows for sure what expenses in these five categories are going to be each and every year, but a reasonable estimate so that we then have something to point to and say that is a reasonable amount we need to protect with a lifetime inexhaustible financial resource that we happen to call secure income, which we'll get to in a minute. So let's pretend you want to create your own minimum dignity floor. You're kind of embracing our approach and want to understand what expenses should I have in this category. And Jim kind of mentioned them at a high level: food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. So let me tackle them one at a time. Food is really, maybe in hindsight, we should have called groceries or grocery store items or something, because in our view, it is food itself, food that you eat at home, not dining out. That's more of a luxury, discretionary kind of an item. But food, clearly you need. But then you also buy a lot of stuff at the grocery store, at least I do. And that would include paper goods, toiletries, cleaning supplies, stuff like that. So there's really no other natural place to put those. So it kind of all gets bundled up in here. So if you're trying to estimate your own what we call food in the minimum dignity floor. Just think of all the stuff that you buy at the grocery store for your house. Primarily in there, obviously, is the food budget itself. So that one's pretty straightforward, and through some reasonable tracking, even if you're not someone who tracks this stuff normally, I think if you paid attention to it for just a month or two, you probably would get a pretty good sense of what you spend at the grocery store. And for those people who don't track it, you might actually be quite surprised how much you spend at the grocery store. But anyway, that's where you'd start. Now, utilities, that's probably one of the easiest for people. And because they've got bills they can look at, they can pull up historical payments that they've made to their various utilities, which can be, you know, electricity, natural gas, heating oil, internet, cable TV, landline phone system if you have it, cell phones, that kind of stuff goes into this utilities category. And so it just take a little bit of effort to assemble that together. And obviously, since you're doing a forward-looking projection, any of those expenses that you expect are going to change, you'd want to accommodate that in some way. If you're moving to a completely different climate, something like that. So that can be a little tricky for most people. If they're doing projections based on their current living situation, it's just a matter of taking a look at the average bills over the past year or two for your various utilities, and there's your estimate. Transportation can be a little tricky. In our view, remember, we're trying to establish those expenses that must be covered if you ran out of assets. And in our view, this is a judgment call on our part, and you could certainly handle this however you please if you're doing it on your own. And on our concept, a retired couple that no longer needs to commute to work, if they truly ran out of assets and were living at their minimum dignity floor, they could do so pretty easily with one vehicle. So we include estimates for the purchase and replacement periodically of one vehicle, including all maintenance, upkeep, repairs, I guess that's maintenance, fuel, registration, insurance, everything that would go for a car. Now, for those of you who have difficulty coming up with your individualized expenses, that can be kind of hard to track. Well, gee, what did I spend last year on oil changes? And I need my fuel bill, and I bought some windshield wipers, and I get tires every 3 or 4 years. All that can be kind of overwhelming from a budgetary standpoint. So quite a few years ago, Jim and I evolved to utilizing the vast data resources that AAA, the American Automobile Association, assembles and makes, you know, provides to the public free of charge, estimates for the true cost of ownership of various types of cars. So you look at the type of car you have, you go to the AAA website, and on there you can find the, you know, cost of ownership estimates on there, and they've evolved that tool a little bit. Now you do some drop downs and answer some questions, and it gives you some estimates for those costs. And that's the approach we use to estimating vehicle costs, because we found when we relied on people coming up with their own, people would oftentimes forget about the things like tire replacements that don't happen very often, and not have a good estimate for what it truly costs to replace the car periodically, and things like that. So we use AAA's resources for this and include one car in the minimum dignity floor. If you chose to include other transportation costs, that would be up to you. Now, a lot of people bring up to me, well, gee, we're doing a projection some 20 or 30 years into the future. We probably won't even own our own cars in 20 or 30 years. We'll be using, you know, automated cars that we just summon with our smartphone, and it comes and picks us up and takes us wherever. We admit that that's certainly possible. The world evolves and things change, but I'm pretty sure that that service won't be free. So we've got, you know, by including expenses based on current transportation costs, we're going to continue those throughout the plan all the way to the bitter end, assuming that you're going to have some type of transportation costs, even if it isn't your personally owned car that's in your garage. I have no idea how we might, you know, model something that we can't see yet as a new reality. So we just continue those existing transportation costs off into the future. You could have changed that if you, in your estimation, transportation costs are going to be cut in half when we have robot cars. You could do that in your projections. We choose not to do that. The housing, the next category, This is pretty broad, and it includes things related to the house, like property taxes, a budget for periodic repairs and durable goods replacements, so replacing your washer and dryer and refrigerator every once in a while, HOA dues if you have them, property insurance, all kinds of stuff that are unique to your particular housing situation. And that's going to be a matter of being self-aware of what you pay for all those types of things and using reasonable estimates for housing costs. Some people live in very expensive to maintain houses. Other people live in maybe a townhome situation, so they have very, very low maintenance, just higher HOA dues or something. So the makeup of your housing category is going to be quite unique to your circumstances, but just need to assemble the costs in that regard. Some people ask me about mortgages. Mortgages, I would argue, are both a housing expense and also a legal obligation to pay. It's a loan that you've signed a promissory note to pay on some kind of regular schedule, at least if we're talking about a traditional mortgage. And this is a good time for me to point out that even though when we list food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, we don't mention loans. Loans are, in our view, a required expense that must be paid. Mortgages, we handle a couple of different ways, because remember what I started my portion of this conversation with, which was we're trying to establish the minimum dignity floor so that we have a good estimate for how much secure income is appropriate for a particular household or particular couple or individual. Mortgages are a little different than a regular housing expense, if you think about it, because mortgages don't oftentimes last forever. Now, if you have a fresh 30-year mortgage and you're 80 years old, it probably is for you forever. But if you still have 15 years left on your mortgage and you're retiring, at some point in retirement, you're going to have that thing paid off. So we kind of look at the mortgage on a one-off. Sometimes it's appropriate to include it in the standard minimum dignity floor. Other times it's appropriate for us to kind of peel that off to the side. And the advantage we have in kind of addressing the payment of a mortgage is it's much more predictable than a normal expense. Normal expenses are affected by inflation and some unpredictableness to them. A mortgage has a legal definition of, you know, of what has to be paid when, and we know exactly what has to be funded. So sometimes we carve it off and handle it a little bit differently. So I did want to point that out. But a mortgage, if you have one, could very well be part of your housing category, if you think about it. But it needs to be looked at a little critically to determine if it truly should be treated as a normal minimum dignity floor expense or funded with a little different strategy or approach. And then healthcare, the last one. And we list that one last because for most couples, as they age, healthcare is going to be the single largest category in the minimum dignity floor. It's not true for everybody, particularly if you have a large mortgage. But lacking a large mortgage, healthcare is likely to be the largest. This one can be tricky to estimate because a lot of times people are retiring before they've entered 65 plus years, where they get the predictable nature of Medicare. And so you've got to fund maybe some period to kind of bridge from retirement until 65. The two spouses, if there's a couple, one is going to transition onto Medicare at a different age than another. Sometimes there's an employer benefit that has continued for one or both of them. So healthcare, we spend a lot of time on, and you would have to spend a lot of time understanding your circumstances. The good news is, if you are just looking for price estimates, in almost every state, you can just go to the healthcare marketplace and shop for policies and see what does someone who's 63 years old, which is maybe when you're targeting retirement, a 63-year-old in my state, what is a policy in the marketplace if I just had to buy one with my own money until I turn 65? What's that going to cost me? And you can get some estimates there, and you'd want to include some estimates for some out-of-pocket expenses, because like with most insurance, you're going to have some out-of-pocket exposure as well. You don't want to budget for that kind of stuff, and include some kind of budget for dental, vision, and hearing, which if you don't need it now, you can't assume you'll never need it. You should budget in for those types of things. And then there's a lot of resources, AAA, several Medicare resource locations that can give you estimates on Medicare costs. And so, you know, once you reach 65 in your projections, you'd have a different set of healthcare costs, which are likely a bit lower for almost everyone compared to the open market, unless you have a lot of income and you're paying Medicare premium surcharges, otherwise known as IRMA. And so healthcare can be, I'd say, the most challenging category for do-it-yourselfers to try to come up with. We spent a lot of time researching resources that could give us reasonable estimates for healthcare costs in retirement. Some are publicly available, others are not. And we use kind of a blend of approaches depending on each client's circumstances. If they have an employer benefit, we obviously have to have the clients supply to us information about what that benefit looks like as far as premiums and coverage and out-of-pocket exposure and all that kind of stuff. So a fair amount of time has to be spent getting some reasonable estimates for the healthcare side. And something I haven't mentioned throughout this whole thing is that you need to be, in our opinion, kind of think critically about the inflation assumptions that you use. We are proponents of using individualized inflation assumptions, recognizing the fact some expenses are likely to inflate at different rates than others. Healthcare, which we landed on just recently, the last category, has proven to be over the last 20 plus years inflating at higher, noticeably higher rates than standard inflation. So while you might use kind of generally accepted rates of inflation or averages for a lot of your other minimum dignity floor expenses, you should really think about, say, property insurance inflation in Florida in particular. Maybe, you know, other places prone to natural disasters. I think it's reasonable to assume that your property insurance is going to inflate a little faster than it maybe has historically. Medical costs, I would say using a number somewhere in the 5 to 6 range, if you consider 3% average inflation, I think a premium of almost double that on healthcare is prudent. Although, in my opinion, I think healthcare costs over the next 20 to 30 years cannot continue at double standard average inflation rates. I don't think that's sustainable. But for now, out of our conservative nature, we tend to still assume those inflation rates continue indefinitely. But you could make your own decision whether you are going to model those things when in your estimates as slowing down a little bit. But I do think it's prudent to look critically at all your individual minimum dignity floor expenses in particular and use your best judgment as to inflationary assumptions on those. Now, I'm assuming you're coming up with your minimum dignity floor and projecting it into the future. If you're just wondering what your minimum dignity floor is right now, just gathering data to establish what this is, and what you have now is kind of a good representation of what your minimum dignity floor is likely to be moving forward, unless you drastically change your lifestyle or move to a new location or completely different size house and neighborhood or some of those things. I'm assuming maybe you're a do-it-yourselfer coming up with the minimum dignity floor, which then to do projections, you've got to have inflation assumptions in there. And that's why I wanted to mention maybe some guidance on inflation, just to be conservative and prudent in your assumptions for inflation, and don't just throw what is always kind of bantered about as, quote, and I'm doing air quotes with my fingers here, average inflation in the United States of maybe 3%. That's a number that's used widely in our industry. But when it comes to the minimum dignity floor in particular, I think you're going to find that a number of those expenses in the minimum dignity floor inflate faster than average. And so we want to make sure you're not maybe underestimating your minimum dignity floor when you're 80 because you didn't use high enough inflation rates on the estimates. So keep that in mind. Last thing I'll mention, you know, healthcare does have insurance premiums in it, but there can be insurance premiums above and beyond healthcare and car insurance and homeowners insurance, which we kind of covered in the transportation, housing, and healthcare categories, life insurance premiums, long-term care insurance premiums, you know, other types of insurance premiums you might have, umbrella policy, usually we bundle up in housing, but could be thought of as an independent premium. In our approach, loan payments, whether they're a mortgage or not, and insurance premiums are minimum dignity floor items that must be funded. Because if you have the need to cover or protect something with insurance, we want to make sure that you can maintain that protection if you happen to run out of assets and you're relying just on the secure income to cover it. So in our view, you obviously everyone can use their own version of this if you're trying to replicate what we do, but insurance premiums we do include in minimum dignity floor for that reason. And I think those are kind of the two one-offs, loan payments and insurance premiums don't always cleanly fit within food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. Jim, do you think I've left anything out as far as the basic structure of the minimum dignity floor?
No, I think you got everything, Chris, on the minimum dignity floor. But when I used to deliver plans, mm-hmm. and now that I've come out of retirement of delivering retirement plans and training Jake, one of the junior planners in our office, one of the things I often tell people is that there is a sixth expense in the minimum dignity floor that I personally don't feel should be a minimum dignity floor expense, but many people do, including the programmers of the financial planning software we use. Mm-hmm. And you'll see where I'm going with this, folks, because I know this is running through many of your heads. When we switched to the program that we use now, this is going back over a decade now, and I started asking Chris and the gentleman who helped us at the time named Gabe to provide me a visualization of someone's minimum dignity floor, because for years we would analyze row upon row upon row of numbers. So all you do-it-yourself Vanguard VG Excel spreadsheet people, visualize your numbers. Turn them into bar graphs. Don't just stare at numbers. And I wanted visualizations because we can pick up anomalies very quickly with visualization, as opposed to staring at numbers and saying, well, that number just doesn't look right. So what I told them is I wanted food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses identified, segregated, and put into bar graphs so I can project the bar graphs, look for anomalies, and make sure those expenses are modeling the way they should, which is from the lower left to the upper right, because they should be increasing at stated rates of inflation. And when they started presenting it to me, something didn't look right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And what it was, folks, it was too big, was it not, Chris?
It was too big, and it usually showed up at a particular age.
Yeah. So I'm looking at it, and I remember chatting with Chris and Gabe. I'm like, this doesn't look right. And when we delved into it, the software would identify what we called minimum dignity floor. They called, quote unquote, required expenses. And we confirmed any expense in the cash flow entered as a food, utility, transportation, housing, and healthcare should be put into the required column. Why the hell was that column bigger than we thought? And when we called up tech support, we figured it out. Tech support told us this sixth expense by default in their software is a required expense, ergo minimum dignity floor by our definition. Yours truly was on that call and yours truly was not pleased. And I told them, I want that out. How do I remove that expense? And they said to me, how can you honestly remove that expense. And I said, simple. If my clients had no money, that expense would likely go away, or go away to a lot greater degree than what you're projecting. Food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, though, do not go away. If my client runs out of money, they have to cover those five categories or they die. If your expense is not, excuse me, if they had no money, your expense almost fully goes away. I'm sure most of you can figure out this mystery sixth expense. It's known as your uncle or taxes. And we hear this constantly. Where do taxes fit into minimum dignity floor? In fact, we received this email. And remember, this is supposed to be a dialogue series. So feel free as we walk through the rest of the month of May up to Annuity Awareness Month in June. In our process and approach, we're going to hopefully be dedicating the Q&A shows to this and the EDU shows. We received this email, Chris. And he, I'm going to skip the state hint and everything just to be brief. And he wrote, I have been sharing what I have learned with my wife and played a short clip for her to explain your concept of the minimum dignity floor. After hearing Jim say the minimum dignity floor is food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses, my wife, who often asks extremely insightful questions, said to me without skipping a beat, why did he not include taxes? I, of course, had no answer. So, Jim, why don't you include taxes? My answer to you is the same answer I gave the software programmer who said they by default, because it's taxes, it is a required expense. Admitted to me, they never thought that, gee, if somebody had no money, they would not owe taxes. So is it theoretically a required expense? That debate could go on and on, like potato, potato, who knows? But I know the way we look at things, if you have an IRA and you're taking money out of it, by default, you have the money to cover the required taxes on that distribution. But if you had no IRA, the government doesn't send you a tax bill for money that you should have paid them if you had money in the IRA. They don't say, oh, you owe us this money anyways. We just hate you. Give us money. So in my simplistic approach, why would you want to? Because remember, folks, I believe minimum dignity floor expenses should be covered with lifetime guaranteed secure income. So why would I want to annuitize or protect with a lifetime stream of guaranteed income an expense that would go away for the most part if you had no money? Now, Chris and I will concede, and he's going to take over in a second and explain what he does and how he chats to people about this. We will concede buried in secure income itself is a degree of taxation. I say a degree because some Social Security is tax-free. And if you ever got, and most people listening to this podcast, you've got millions. You're not going to run out of money. We get that. However, conceptually, it doesn't change our rationale for thinking the way we do. But if you did run out of money, much of your Social Security would be tax favored in the way that Social Security is taxed. If you annuitized a Roth IRA, your lifetime stream of income could be tax free. So there is a degree of taxes that will be owed on secure income. But there is no need to put all your taxes into the concept of minimum dignity floor, at least at the gross level, net out your taxes from distributions from IRAs and brokerage accounts and things like that, and look at the net tax number, you don't want to annuitize and protect the gross tax number. Because if you didn't have that IRA money, which is where most of you are going to have your massive taxes, if you didn't have that IRA, if it was all converted into a Roth, or you spent it and it was gone, or sadly you lost it in a scam or a bad investment, you wouldn't have a tax bill. So in my mind, I never wanted taxes as part of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses. And again, the software programmer, they admitted to us they had never looked at it that way. Now, they didn't change their software just for us.
Because we're the only ones who asked that question.
But conceptually, to me, it's not a quote-unquote required expense. If required expense is just a euphemism for my definition of minimum dignity floor. To me, minimum dignity floor is an expense. If you do not cover, you will suffer an economic, financial, or medical hardship. And I jokingly say, if you do not cover your tax liability, you will not suffer an economic, financial, or medical hardship. Instead, you will actually be in a better financial situation. How? Your housing and healthcare and food and utilities will be covered by your uncle, because they're going to pay for your housing and your healthcare and your utilities, and your transportation needs will go away. And if you do have to be transported at all, your uncle will take you to wherever you have to be transported, because you'll go to jail, folks. At a simple level, if you don't cover your taxes, you will not suffer an economic, financial, or medical hardship. So I often come back with that retort for people who say, but you'll go to jail. I say, well, technically, then you're going to get free housing, free food, free healthcare, so you're in a better financial situation. So I'm surprised.
That's financial planner humor.
Yes, only a financial planner will laugh at that. So what I'm getting to, folks, we do factor taxes, but we don't consider them for all the reasons I shared. Truly part of my definition of MDF. But Chris, go one step further and explain what you talked to people about.
Yeah, and
about.
I think for people who aren't convinced of the logic here, consider this. Your income taxes aren't created and are owed due to an expense, because you pay your house bills and you pay your utilities and stuff. That doesn't generate income taxes. What generates income taxes is the recognition of income. So the taxes are really something that offsets your income. So that's kind of a way to look at it, is we need enough after-tax secure income to cover the true minimum dignity floor expenses, which means to accomplish that, if you'd run out of assets and were relying just on secure income, the secure income simply needs to be large enough to do two things: cover the true minimum dignity floor expenses and cover the taxes that are owed on the secure income itself. That's it. If you're covering more taxes than that with your secure income approach, you are, in our eyes, over annuitizing, because that's usually where you generate more secure income if needed, is through annuitization, handing over money to an entity, an insurance company, that will in exchange provide you with a lifetime guarantee of income. That's the natural place people go to if they need more. And if you're trying to cover all these crazy taxes with your secure income, you're likely going to have to engage with an insurance company. And I think we've argued not doing that, that the assets, the accounts that generate the taxes, if they exist to generate those taxes, they exist and are able to pay the taxes associated with those distributions. So you can think of those as kind of a different flavor of taxes rather than the taxes on the secure income itself. So
exactly,
that's kind of our particular approach, because remember, to circle back to my original comment before I started talking this show, is that we want to establish a reasonable way of determining how much secure income you need. we don't want to push you into more secure income than really is needed for a reasonable foundation. I mean, some people could argue, if you're not following our approach, gee, why don't I just simplify my life and I'll cover everything with secure income? That's a different approach. That's not what we're promoting. You could choose to go that route, though. That's an alternative way of funding your retirement, certainly. If you're instead like us, trying to create a reasonable, in our eyes, what we believe to be a reasonable foundation or safety net or some level below which you cannot fall and cover other expenses that are more flexible, discretionary, etc., with other means other than secure income, that explains why we're doing it the way we're doing it. We're trying to create this foundation that's reasonable in size, not going to the extreme of covering everything with secure income, just those things that have kind of been elevated to this utmost importance level: food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, and as a sideline, the taxes that might be attached to the secure income itself.
Right. So let's, as we wrap this up, look at the secure income. In my opinion, again, the secure income is a crucial part of your minimum dignity floor. Even for you all you Vanguard VGs out there with a million or 2 million or 3 million or 4 million or 5 million or 6 million and 7 million, so on and so forth. And if you don't have that much, don't get discouraged. I'm right now talking to the people who conceptually have enough money where outliving their assets isn't necessarily a concern. Why would you still want to use secure income? Well, for a couple of reasons. First of all, in order to come up with the jewel of our approach to retirement, which is the fun number, you have to first make an explicit promise to the older you, and there'll always be an older you, an explicit promise to them that their food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses will be covered forever, no matter how long they live. The best way to make that explicit promise is to show the older you, and therefore the younger you, to see and articulate, especially if you have difficulty from an emotional standpoint spending your money on fun. If you knew as a younger person all those expenses are covered for the older you for as long as they live with income that can never go away, Maybe emotionally you will feel more comfortable spending on fun. Or if you have a spouse who's very hesitant to spend and another one of you really want to, going through this exercise can emotionally make both of you feel good. But you also have to be able to articulate some sort of dollar amount that must be reserved. Even if you loathe annuities and you're never going to annuitize and take care of the shortage between your pension, if you have one, and Social Security and what your minimum dignity floor is, even if you're loathe to annuitize that, you should still use the actuarial brilliance that annuities have, or annuity companies, the insurance companies themselves, employ dozens and dozens and dozens of actuaries. These people know statistics and know what it costs to protect streams of income. You should still use annuities to tell you the dollar amount you need to reserve. So that's why you should walk through this exercise. But to us, secure income is simple. It's three-part definition, folks. It's not rocket science. Don't overthink it. First, your income is predetermined and known. There's no ambiguity. What you're going to get at, say you're going to retire at 65. What you're going to get at 65 is known, and it's very easy to project with a strong degree of accuracy what you'll get at 66, 7, 68, 69, 70, so on and so forth, right up to death hopefully well into your 90s. So it's predetermined and known, and there's no ambiguity. A lot of sources of income don't fall into that category. Bank CDs don't. You don't know what the interest rate's going to renew at. Bond ladders don't. Royalties, which here in Colorado, we hit a lot of clients with royalties. Royalties are not guaranteed. Rents, net rental income. You don't know what you're going to net every year.
Dividends.
There's many sources of income that don't technically fall into secure income. Second part of the definition. So predetermined and known. Number two, if it moves at all, it can only move up. It's like a ratchet set, for those of you who know what a ratchet is. If it moves at all, it's only in one direction. It can go up, but can't go down. And number three, it's not backed by your dollars, because remember, if you run out of money, something happens. The money runs out. What if you might be brilliant, but what if you're not so brilliant later on and someone stole your money and you're a victim of financial fraud and nobody's making you whole? If you ran out of money, the income stops. In secure income, because it's risk pooling, they call it, you are pooling with millions of other investors. If someone outlives their money or whatever the case may be, the other people in the pool are supporting them. So that's secure income. It's the bottomless cup of coffee. It's the same approach. You go to a restaurant where you get one cup of coffee, that's it. When that coffee's gone, you got to buy it again or you're SOL. Or you go to those cafes that hand you that thick ceramic white mug and they're going to come by and keep filling that cup of coffee as many times as you want for as long as you're there. It's a bottomless cup of coffee. That's the difference. So to us, covering the minimum dignity floor with secure income is crucial. Now, next week, we're going to talk to you about how to go about using insurance companies and their actuaries to determining your shortage. Tools that you can use on your own. You're not going to have access to the tools that we use. They're only available to professionals. But there are some websites you can utilize to kind of make a determination and how to adjust for inflation on your secure income. Now that you have your minimum dignity floor and you figured it out and you projected it, and now you kind of understand the concept of covering it forever with lifetime secure income, how do you now figure out the dollar amount? How do you do that part? That we're going to cover next week. We're going to give you some ideas, some tips, some things to think of. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask them. Send them to us. Just make sure you can, in the subject line, I know it's a dialogue on this series, and I'll either include it on a Q&A show or on a future show. Anything you want to add, Chris, before we wrap up?
No. If we think of anything, we have more shows to come that we can add. If I forgot anything as a part of the minimum digging floor, maybe if you think we left something out or something needs additional clarification, shoot us an email. That's what this is all about, kind of that dialogue concept as we go through this. We'd be happy to clarify things on the fly if you've got a point to make or a question or suggestion. So just send that email directly to Jim. Jim@jimhelps.com is the email address. That's jimhelps.com. Put in the subject line current dialogue or something like that, or podcast dialogue, and that'll catch his attention. And we'll just take the next step and start expanding on this concept of secure income, sources, manipulations, choices, etc. The fact that maybe all of your minimum dignity floor expenses from day one don't need secure income. So we'll talk about the delay period, the post-delay period, things like that, which play a part in the secure income strategy that's used to cover the minimum dignity floor. We'll expand. We'll get into that, all that next week. Does that sound good, Jim?
Perfect for me.
Okay. Well, thanks everybody for listening, keeping up with us, and got several more shows to go, so hopefully this is of interest to you. If nothing else, you will get a good refresher on our approach, and if you're new to listening, you'll have a great understanding of what we're all about by the time we're done with this series. So we appreciate you all. Thanks for sending in your emails, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.